Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dar Jamayo. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's a full-time staff reporter for truthout.org. His work is currently focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption. And when we say that he is an award-winning journalist and author, he writes about some of the most important issues of our time. He's written about U.S. imperialism and the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He has written about veterans who don't wish to go to war or who are against war and against U.S. imperialism. And he's written about the BP oil spill. He's written about fracking. And he's primarily working, or much of his work these days, is about climate change. So first, thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you for your work, Dar.
Thank you, Derek. It's great to be with you.
So can you tell me a little bit about, A, your work on global warming, and B, or as you say, climate disruption, and B, tell me about climate disruption itself?
Well, I decided after doing years and years of reporting on U.S. imperialism, focusing primarily on the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and covering that the best I could, even during all that time, I knew in the background of my mind that, you know, the single biggest story going forward is environmentalism and specifically anthropogenic climate disruption, i.e. global warming / climate change. It's because at the end of the day, it's real simple. If we destroy the planet upon which we are a part of and rely on and live on, no other story is going to be quite that important going forward. So I shifted really with my reporting on, started with the covering the BP oil disaster, the single largest marine oil spill in the history of the country, as just one actually small example of what humans are doing to the planet. And I basically tangented out from there to go into broader climate change coverage. And I do prefer to call it anthropogenic climate disruption because I just think it's important to be precise. And that is a precise yet concise definition, I think, of what the phenomena is. And so I really have been writing stories on that. Truthout has been generous enough to allot me a platform, which we call the Anthropogenic Climate Disruption Dispatch, which I produce one per month. And they've given me my own little section there to fill up with these types of stories. And so every month I'm going through and doing a tally of climate change related stories over the last month that have occurred, important scientific reports that have been released, studies that have been done, and other evidence occurring around the globe that shows us how far along we are on this path. And if we really look closely at what's happening, as far as reports that are coming out, NASA studies, evidence of extreme weather events, et cetera, it's really shocking. And I know that you are acutely aware of these things, but I think the average reader or listener to this program who, given you and the content of what you're producing is, I think it's safe to say, far above average in being really well read and understanding the crisis that we're in and how far along we are. Even given that, I think when we really look closely on a daily, weekly, monthly basis of how fast this is occurring, it's really, really shocking. I mean, I wrote an article for Tom Englehart's website back in December, tomdispatch.com, and we titled this article The Climate Change Scorecard, or more specifically, Are We Falling Off the Climate Precipice? And, you know, in short, the answer is we are in free fall off that precipice. I mean, just I included the timeline in that, and I'll just run through it briefly. And this, I think, gives us an idea of how far along and how fast we're moving off that precipice. In late 2007, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is notoriously conservative in their announcements and their predictions about where we're going to be regarding rising temperatures. So in 2007, they announced that the planet's going to see a 1 degree C temperature increase by 2100. And then about a year later in 2008, the Hadley Center for Meteorological Research predicted a 2 degree C increased by 2,100. Half a year later, the middle of 2009, the UN's environment program predicts a 3.5C increase by 2,100, bearing in mind that no humans have ever lived on a planet at 3.5C above baseline or higher. Just a few months after that, in October 2009, the Hadley Center for Meteorological Research, they released an updated prediction over their 2008 2C prediction, and they now said a 4C temperature increase by 2060. The next month, 2009, the Global Carbon Project, a group from the Copenhagen Diagnosis, along with the Copenhagen Diagnosis, a science report, they predicted a 6 and 7C temperature increase by 2100, respectively. About a year after that, in December 2010, the UN Environment Program, they upgraded their previous prediction to 5C increase by 2050. In 2012, the Conservative International Energy Agency, they released a report predicting a 2C increase by just 2017. And then a little bit later in November 2013, that same group, the International Energy Agency, they predicted a 3.5C increase by 2035. So if we look at the trend, we keep seeing higher temperature predictions over shorter time periods. The graphs are all going hockey stick at this point, meaning basically straight up. And consistently what we see, and disconcertingly what we see, is that each prediction becomes increasingly dire in how fast it's outpacing previous predictions.
Well, there's a couple directions I would like to go with this. One of them is that right now I'm writing a book on human supremacism, which I think is one of the worst problems we face. And there's a little bit that I did recently based on this one scientist had a sentence where he was talking about, quote, a remarkable underestimation of the extent to which the ocean has been reorganized. And my response to that in the book is to say, wow, reorganized. I guess that's one word for it. I'm not sure, however, if that's the language that most of us would use, were we the victims of the reorganization. Then we might say theft, murder, genocide, ecocide. And then here's the point of why I'm bringing all this up. There's a paragraph I just wrote about this, that some members of this human supremacist culture are materially benefiting from actions, read theft and murder, leading to the, quote, reorganization of the oceans. And what do you know? It is members of this human supremacist culture who are consistently underestimating the extent of the harm caused by this theft and murder. Remarkable. Who'd have thunk that thieves and murderers who consider themselves superior to those they steal from and murder would underestimate the harm caused by the thefts and murders they perpetrate. And there's a couple directions with this. One of them is that this is what we've seen consistently. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I remember seeing something a few years ago that said that basically every time there's a new estimate on global warming, there is, I believe, or climate change, climate disruption, there is an 83% chance, I believe, that it's going to be worse than the estimate before. And that there has been I'm not saying there's a big conspiracy theory, but what I'm saying is there has been a consistent, at every step of the way, underestimation. And the reason I'm going off on all this is because this is not just on climate disruption. This is what we see with nanotechnology. This is what we see with the effects of invasives. This is what we see with DDT. This is what we see with everything that's put out by this culture, pretty much, that destroys the natural world, is a consistent and ubiquitous, I would say, underestimation of the harm it's going to cause to others. So that's all. I just wanted to say, to put this in the larger pattern of this abusive culture doing this about every harm that is caused. And when I say that, I don't want to underestimate, I'm not underestimating the horror of what you're saying. I'm saying that this culture, of course, when you have a culture that's based on systematically, I love this phrase, on privatizing profits and externalizing costs, of course it's going to underestimate those costs it's externalizing onto the others. But in this case, we're actually talking about the murder of the planet.
I don't think you putting that out there, you know, underestimates at all, you know, the information that I'm talking about and that we both know is happening. And I think it's an extremely important point. I think it's very informative about why we keep seeing these gross underestimations in the predictions, particularly coming out of the IPCC. I mean, this is an extremely political body that's extremely heavily influenced by governments around the world, particularly those in the West that don't want to do what has to be done to try to mitigate, not stop or change, but at this point, just try to mitigate, hopefully, some of the extreme impacts that are coming down the pike with climate disruption. And I think your point is extremely well made about, yeah, it's you know, the murderer, the rapist, the killer, the thief, of course they're going to try to cover their tracks. You know, business depends upon it, and that's exactly what we're seeing. And, you know, speaking to the oceans, and I know I've heard you talk about some of the genocide basically that's happening within the oceans, but you know, they've already lost at minimum 40% of their phytoplankton, which just happens to be the base of the global oceanic food chain. Kind of important also considering that that produces about half of the oxygen on the entire planet. And this is of course all because of climate change induced acidification and atmospheric temperature variations. And you know, it's happening to such an extent. I quote the Center for Ocean Studies in one of my articles, who said, quote, "The oceans have absorbed almost one half of human released CO2 emissions since the Industrial Revolution. Although this has moderated the effect of greenhouse gas emissions, it's chemically altering marine ecosystems 100 times more rapidly than it has changed in the last 650,000 years. I mean, this, we're talking about already being well along the sixth great mass extinction event the planet has already seen. How much further are we going to go? You know, we're looking at, you know, 5 to 6 C predictions. Even the conservative IPCC is saying, yes, we could have as high as a 6 C increase by 2100. And I've written some other articles more recently since that report came out a couple of months ago, quoting some very, very prestigious climate change scientists who are saying, yes, we are looking very, it's looking very likely that we're going to see 6C by 2100. I asked Guy McPherson, a professor emeritus from University of Arizona, and he's a evolutionary biologist among other PhDs. And he's been studying climate disruption for the last 25 years. And I said, well, Dr. McPherson, what does a 6C planet look like? Contextualize that for me, because me and I think most of my readers, we don't really understand what that means aside from massive climate disruption, the obvious of living on a much hotter planet, what that's going to do to disrupt food availability, water, et cetera. He said, well, you know, again, first of all, I'll remind you that humans have never lived on a planet at 3.5C or higher than it is right now. And secondly, last time the Earth was 6C above baseline, there were the largest living mammal was the size of a shrew, and there were snakes in the Amazon that were the size of yellow school buses.
And what he says horrifies me, but I actually think that things are far worse because, at that point, there were still corridors for animals to move to flee to the poles or flee. This climate change I've just learned recently, this is actually faster by far than any of the previous times that the climate has shifted during previous mass extinctions, and a huge advantage that the beings had at that point is that they weren't also stressed. They were suffering one stress as opposed to the stress of endocrine disruption and nuclear toxification, other forms of toxification, heavy metals pollution. So they were undergoing, it'd be like a human patient who has one sickness versus you have seven other, you already have pneumonia, tuberculosis, and cancer, and then they're throwing on something else in addition that causes a tremendous fever, as opposed to just getting a fever. This is, there are many, many other stressors that are adding to the murder of the planet. Do you see what I'm trying to say? That things are actually even more dire for the real world than they would have been under previous conditions, because at that point the world had not been bathed for a century in endocrine disruptors.
Yeah, I would agree, because also then we throw in the fact that there's about 450 active nuclear power plants around the planet, that once we start losing infrastructure and the grid from extreme weather events, from rising seas, etc., from economic chaos, from resource wars that are certainly going to increase resources, not just being fossil fuels, but it will be about water and land. It already is. That's already happening. But as that continues to move forward, it takes about 10 years to safely shut down an active nuclear power plant. What happens when we lose that capability, when we start losing the grid and losing the infrastructure and the capability to actually not just run those things, which are clearly not safe just to run, but to safely shut them down? That's going to obviously compound the problem and other things that you noted. But then we also have the fact that as far as the rapidity at which this is happening, I think it just underscores what you just said. I mean, we had a report that was published in Science in August 2013 that revealed that in the near term, the very near term, Earth's climate will change 10 times faster than at any other moment in the last 65 million years. I mean, and we're seeing that happen, and we're seeing runaway positive feedback loops like the methane releases in the Arctic that are being well documented by many teams of scientists, including NASA itself, that show, look, we're already seeing massive methane releases that occurred during the Permian mass extinction that happened 250 million years ago that wiped out 90% of all species on the planet. And we're ramping up way, way faster. That was an event that took place over thousands and thousands of years, which is already, geologically speaking, very, very fast in geologic time. And yet we're doing things so much faster than that. And then, the rate of evolution, there have been other studies, one actually published also in August 2013, but in a journal called Ecology Letters, that showed that the rate of evolution trails the rate of climate change by a factor of 10,000, meaning, if people think, we can just adapt, or crops can adapt, or animals can adapt, well, guess what? It takes them times the factor of time to adapt to what we're doing to the planet. And so there's so many things like this where, it's not just like a giant volcanic eruption has gone off that it's causing this change or some other natural event. But what we've done is so completely unprecedented to anything that's ever happened before on the planet, save maybe the meteor strike that took out the dinosaurs, that it is, I think, hard for people to get their minds around it. But we're already seeing it happen so fast. We're seeing changes happen so fast. And I think, and at that point, it gets into the hysteria and the level of denial happening from oil and gas companies. And then, of course, that bearing out within the political system of the U.S. and the better part of the Western world, that's, of course, ramping up right alongside the chaos.
Why do you think that there are? I remember reading this quote years ago from some scientist, I don't remember who, saying that if there were some sort of if we were in a war and somebody were just spreading endocrine disruptors all over the place, we would be running around screaming that this is an atrocity and we would be trying to stop it. But because it's just happening as business as usual, most of us don't think about it. And it's the same thing here, that if aliens came down from outer space and they were changing the climate and murdering the oceans, I would hope we would resist. But in this case, the primary resistance seems to be to resisting facing reality. And so do you, I mean, we're talking about life on the planet, and we're talking about, I mean, there are stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans, that saltwater fish could be extinct within 30 years. Saltwater fish, saltwater fish, the oceans. I mean, and you just said a 40% decrease in phytoplankton already. And why are we not all running around screaming and doing everything we can to stop this? I mean, there can be no disaster bigger than this. Why are we not only not stopping it, but for the most part, I mean, it's like, it just kills me that when people, okay, almost any news coverage you see about the melting of the Arctic ice cap, the attitude of those in power, I think, can only be described as lust for access to minerals in Greenland, to access to the Northwest Passage. It's not horror. It's not. I want to say one more thing, which is I saw this dreadful movie in the 1970s called A Boy and His Dog, and it's just a dreadful misogynist movie about a post-apocalyptic society where there are very few women, and any time a woman is seen, she's raped to death. And it starts off with this character who sees a woman who has recently been raped to death, and he says something effective, wow, that was a shame. And you think, wow, he might have a little bit of decency in him, but his next line is, she still had a couple uses left in her, you know, too bad they killed her. And that seems to me to be the attitude that the capitalists will have till the very end. It's like, oh, God, too bad the world's dead. We could have made a few more dollars first or something. What? How do you, I mean, I've written 20 some books about this and I can't understand it at all. And I mean, do you have any insight into the insanity?
I think there's a lot going on that causes, I think that leads to these questions and causes people to not react in a normal, sane way, I think a normal, sane reaction to what's going on is to basically almost go crazy. I mean, to like, hey, look, the building's on fire. We need to get the F out, or we need to put the thing out. I mean, it's, you know, a very, very severe, intense reaction because, the fine print, you know, don't forget to read the fine print here. We just happen to be killing the entire planet upon which we depend. I think, you know, I could talk for hours, I think, about the cause, but I think, you know, one thing that pops to mind, I mean, and cause I was asking myself questions about why weren't more people going crazy during the lead up to the war on Iraq, where it was so clear that it was all based on lies. And then people thought, oh, we went out and demonstrated for a weekend and that didn't do the job. So I guess I'll just go back to work and, you know, maybe give a few more bucks to the Democratic National Committee. You know, I mean, it's and that just drove me absolutely, well, crazy enough to go dive into the war headfirst myself. But I think what we're looking at is, at least in the United States, this is a population that probably, unlike any other population in the history of the world, has been subjected to decades of corporate propaganda that tells it, buy this because you're less than. Buy this product because you're fat, ugly, stupid, and you're not sexy. And unless you buy this crap, you're not going to be a fulfilled human being. And that kind of inculcating process over decades, coupled with teaching people that, you know, like, you know, half, you know, probably over half the country thinks capitalism is synonymous with democracy. I mean, that's the level of ignorance. While you're slashing education budgets across the board consistently, and then, you know, states like the one where I'm speaking from today, Texas, where they're, you know, basically going to make it illegal to teach critical thinking in public schools. I mean, when all of that together, I think, basically creates a general population where there's this pervading sense of learned helplessness. And so people, I think, do feel absolutely powerless and do believe that there's nothing that they can do. So I might as well just, you know, go back to my job, you know, coupled with the economics of it that, you know, what is it, over 50% of the people in the country are living paycheck to paycheck. So there's a very real economic fear of, hey, I got to just keep making money or I'm literally not going to have enough to eat or not be able to feed my family. I think there's all of, you know, those things going on for starters, coupled with just the result. And I've read so much of what you've written about just the homicidal nature, of the system under which we live, where this is a, you know, it's system as sociopath, where if that's the system, and that's the system where people are having to operate and live and try to earn a living and try to take care of themselves, then of course they're going to be made crazy having to live and operate within that system. They're not going to be able to see things clearly, ergo they're not going to respond accordingly when someone has a gun aimed right at their head.
Well, I think everything you say makes a lot of sense there. It makes so much sense. And you mentioned about the Iraq War, and that is a story of your becoming involved in attempting to stop the Iraq War is a story that Your story is a story that I've told a whole bunch of times because I find it so incredibly inspiring, and it's one of the things I love about you. And can you tell, and I'll give the moral real quickly, which is you saw something wrong and instead of just complaining about it, you set out to fix it. And I love that. That's, I think, such an important, inspiring model for all of us. So can you tell that story?
I will. I'll start with the fact that, you know, I didn't become politicized until relatively late in my own life. I mean, I was raised in Texas in a conservative Republican family and didn't really have an understanding of what politics even really were, other than, okay, well, I guess I'm a Republican. And so I moved to Alaska in 1996, just basically to mountain climb. I just wanted to be out in nature. And I took a job working as a personal assistant to a man named Dwayne French, who was then the director of the State of Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. So he, as a quadriplegic, was in charge of the state system that helped other people with disabilities get and keep jobs. And I started working for him. We hit it off. We became fast friends. He was a political appointee, a blue blood Democrat, and he at one point asked me, "So, Dar, what are your politics?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'm a Republican." And he said, well, he became visibly agitated and he said, "Oh, you guess you're a Republican. So what are the policies of the Democrats do you oppose? Which policies of the Republicans do you support? Why aren't you an anarchist or an independent or a libertarian?" And I didn't know anything. I was completely unable to answer any of his questions. And I became very embarrassed and frustrated. And so I reacted by saying, "Well, Dwayne, it doesn't matter because whatever the government does doesn't really affect us anyway." And I could see him turn red and he said, "Oh, you really believe that?" He said, well, think about this. Right now, the state of Alaska legislature is trying to pass a bill, which if it goes through, I will not have funding anymore to have a weekend personal assistant. So, what I want you to do is when you go home this Friday and you go to sleep, I want you to stay in bed from Friday to Monday morning, because that's what would happen to me. I would have to spend the entire weekend in bed. He said, "So I want you to run this experiment with yourself. Somewhere around the middle of the day, Saturday, you're going to be laying in your own piss and shit. And then by that night, you're going to run out of water to drink. And then you're going to stay there from Saturday night until all through Sunday and then until Monday morning. I want you to call me Monday morning and tell me that what they do doesn't affect us." And so that basically began my political education. And I started reading everything I could get my hands on. And, you know, basically politicized myself very quickly. And of course, having Dwayne as a mentor was pivotal in that. And I'm grateful for that to this day. And so by the time the Iraq War rolled around, watching what was happening on the world stage, watching the lies, the propaganda, watching it just play out in real time on the world stage, that this massive military misadventure was going to be launched, and people were just buying it by and large. And I was going crazy. I mean, to me, I started to have a healthy human response, like we alluded to earlier, that I felt like, hey, look, we have to go to any lengths necessary to try to stop this, because the normal channels of writing letters to our so-called political representatives and doing demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience, you know, all of which I did nothing. So we need to take it to the next level. And so to me, I felt like, well, if people had real information about what was going on and how this invasion and occupation was directly impacting the Iraqi people that had already suffered for over a dozen years of the harshest economic sanctions in modern history, I felt like, well, that's something that I could do to help the situation. And so I found out how to get into Iraq. I found a person working in there. I asked him, hey, how do I get in? He said, go stay in this hotel in Amman. From there, you can get a ride in on a car, hire a seat in a car to Baghdad, then stay in this hotel, and you'll meet some other independent folks, and you can get to work. And so I literally just – I had a couple thousand dollars in savings. I got a laptop, a camera, a plane ticket, and I went to Baghdad. And I started writing and sending out email dispatches to about 125, 150 people back in Alaska. And then that started to grow, and then I started posting on a website called electronicirock.net, a sister website of Electronic Intifada that covers Palestine. And I started getting picked up and asked to do some freelance journalism work for BBC and another independent website. And that's basically how I started as a journalist, and it took off from there, because, of course, it was made easier by the fact that Iraq was basically the biggest story of the day for several years running. But that's how I got my start. It was just pure, unfettered outrage and me going crazy at what I was seeing and feeling like, well, I just need to throw myself into the fire and the chips will fall where they do. But, you know, extreme times call for extreme measures. And so I dove in.
Once again, I don't know how many years ago it was that you first told me that story, but I've always loved it and found it so inspiring. And, you know, the big distinction is not between those who believe we need militant resistance and those who believe that militant resistance isn't necessary. I've always thought that the big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. You know, it's just, I mean, every bit of my work is about trying to get people off their butts and doing something. And if, you know, once again, I think about this a lot. People ask me how I've written, you know, 20 some books. And the truth is, I don't actually write books at all. And I've said this before, that I think about something that my great grandmother used to say all the time, which is inch by inch, life's a cinch. And I'm not by that trying to be completely reformist, that we all just need to make incremental change. But the truth is, I write one page, then I write another page, then before you know it, I've got a book. It's like, if you don't like something, that's why I've written all my books, is because I perceived a hole in environmental discourse. And part of the hole was that this culture has a death urge. And I saw some feminists talking about how patriarchy has a death urge. Mary Daly talks about that. And I saw some psychologists talking about it. Eric Fromm, Lewis Mumford, definitely not a psychologist, a sociologist or whatever it was that Lewis Mumford was, just all around genius. So I saw that, but I didn't see any environmentalists talking about it. It's like, and I've said this before too, that I was at Bioneers years and years ago, and it broke my heart because it's all about social change, supposedly, and all about environmental stuff. But I was the only person I know about there who was talking about either power or psychopathology. And my point is, instead of just complaining, oh, gosh, somebody should be talking about power and psychopathology, because you can't talk about social change without talking about power. You can't talk about the murder of the plant without talking about psychopathology. Instead of just me going around grousing to all my friends, oh, my gosh, this is a big problem. It's like, well, somebody's got to do it. And you, more than almost anybody else I know, manifest that. And I just love that. I just want to once again express my deep respect for you on that.
Well, thank you, Derek. I mean, coming from you, that means very much. I mean, a lot of your work has been very inspirational to me along the way also. But that said, I mean, I guess kind of riffing off a little bit of what you were talking about, how and why you write books the way that you do is, I mean, to me, doing that, going into Iraq, and then all the work I've done since then, and why I continue to do the work that I do today is, I mean, at this point, along with helping hopefully inform people and keep people updated on the crisis of our existence at present, it keeps me sane. I can't imagine, you know, if I wasn't doing some kind of work like this, I don't know how I would stay sane living in this situation. I mean, it's like we're basically living in end times. And, you know, if I wasn't doing something proactive and helping stay plugged in to the general public in a way of trying to keep people informed and having regular daily interactions with my readers about things and passing on even further information, it just helps me stay sane. So in a way, it's kind of a selfish motive as well for me, because, you know, without being proactive and something to do, I mean, I think best case scenario, I would fall into the deepest depression. And I guess that's probably why at least one fifth of Americans are on psychotropic meds, if not more. That's probably a very conservative figure, but I would probably fall into that category too if I didn't have my work to do.
Well, that's another thing. Isn't it just really fun to be doing good work? I mean, that's another thing. I mean, when people ask, how are you? It's always very complex because my heart is breaking every moment from the murder of the planet, but I'm also having a tremendous time doing my work. It's personally, you know, personally, I love doing this. I can't think of anything better than, and how wonderful it feels to actually, you know, there's, I don't remember who said this, but somebody or another said that within a culture of lies, to tell the truth is a great gift. And it's not only a gift to the readers. I know that's true for some of the books I've read, you know, Neil Everdon, Susan Griffin's Woman of Nature. When I read those books, I just felt this huge relief. So I get that too. But it's also, for me at least, it's a tremendous relief for the one who does it too, that I feel this, you know, one of the things I used to say at talks all the time is that it's not so much the pain or the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is our resistance to it. And I think it's the same thing is true, for me at least, with these lies. It's just such a relief to be able to stop lying to myself as well. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have the exact same experience. And like you said, it's, you know, I feel like I'm fighting when I'm able to do a story. Like I just did a story on how they're, you know, just another isolated case in point of the insanity of the system that's killing the planet is that, you know, they are now fracking within the 3-mile boundary of the waste isolation pilot plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico. And for those who don't know, that's a deep geologic 2,100 foot deep burial site for nuclear waste. And they are fracking, i.e. hydrofracturing, which is proven to cause earthquakes within the 3-mile boundary of a nuclear waste site. And that kind of thing, and being able to do that kind of story and name names and name the government agencies responsible for allowing this to happen and bring people's attention to it. We need to be throwing fuel on these fires. I feel like whatever it takes to help people see and understand what's going on and hopefully inspire some other people to resist, because, you know, daily there's examples like this of these grievances being carried out against the planet, and it's ramping up. It's not slowing down.
You sent me, I'm hesitating because there was an echo. Okay. You sent me that article. And can you, take like 3 minutes to go through a slightly longer version of what you just said? Because the article is really horrifying. And you said, you know, it's a repository for nuclear waste, but sort of really, don't hold back on giving people the horror and stupidity of this.
Well, this plant was designed where the idea behind it is that there is a deep salt, naturally occurring salt dome, basically, within underground nearby Carlsbad, New Mexico. And the idea is that they can store nuclear waste there from like Los Alamos National Laboratory and nuclear reactors around the country for thousands of generations. The idea is they can put it in this giant naturally occurring salt cave and then store it in there safely in canisters. And then over time, the salt will kind of erode and move in and insulate the containers for thousands of generations. The idea is that, you know, it'll keep it safe for 10,000 years, even though we're going to conveniently overlook the fact that that's not nearly enough time to account for the half-lives of a lot of the waste in there. But nevertheless, that's the idea. The reality is, they started shipping things there in 1999. There's been more than 11,000 shipments of waste, more than 80,000 cubic meters of waste transferred to this site. But problems, there's been problems. There's been ongoing problems. Most recently in February, there was a fire within the site, as well as an external radiation release that was reported even by the Department of Energy itself. So we've already got several instances, actually, of external radiation leaks coming out of this site. And then it's been closed since that time. It's closed as we speak, so it's not taking any more shipments. So that means then that radioactive waste is being stored on site in places like Los Alamos National Labs, just up above Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this is a place where now on numerous occasions in recent years, we've had massive wildfires come very, very close to literally within a couple hundred yards of this waste that's now being stored above ground, which, of course, if it hit, it would cause an international nuclear crisis. That's ongoing as we speak. We look at New Mexico now, something like 90% of the state is in severe drought. We're already looking at new wildfires burning across the state. The stage is set for another record-setting wildfire season. And we have this minor problem of the buildup of nuclear waste being stored above ground because of what's happening at WIP, or at this point not happening regarding shipments. But in short, there's now over 300 active oil and gas drilling sites within 3 miles of the boundary of the waste isolation pilot plant, and there are at least a dozen fracking wells within a mile of the boundary. And so, as I said before, it's well noted that fracking causes earthquakes. You just have to look at North Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas to see that. And they're literally allowing fracking right near a nuclear waste dump site. And to me, this epitomizes the sociopathic nature of the system that is killing the planet, where there is complete, not even on the radar to pay attention to safety issues or how insane that might be. If we might bump up our quarterly profit statement a little bit by dropping a couple of fracking wells right near a nuclear waste site, then so be it. Let's go for it.
So the theme, there are two themes that have emerged from this interview, and one of them seems to me to be the direness of the situation and the insanity and momentum of the destructiveness. And another theme that emerged, for me at least, was the was if you recognize what do we do about it? And so sorry if this is a tall order, but we have like 2 minutes left, and can you bring those two themes together for whatever people who listen to this should think or do? I mean, so is the response to this conversation that people should, as you sort of mentioned, ironically early on, should it be that they give money to the Democratic National Party? Or what should they do?
I think that we're in a time where each person needs to decide what's most important to themselves. And, you know, for me now, it's protecting what's left of the planet, you know, in the beautiful places that I love to go out in nature, in the mountains, and not even to speak of having fresh air, clean water, and clean food to keep me alive. But I think we each need to decide what is most important to us and what are we willing to do to protect it. If we're truly of the earth, which of course all of us are, and part of it, if part of us is being killed, what are we willing to do to defend it? And I think that each one of us needs to make that decision, and responses might range. I think that responses will range across the spectrum from people that aren't willing to do anything. They'd rather just stay in denial and keep looking at their iPad or their iPhone and buying crap and seeing how much money they can make on over to people who are willing to put their bodies on the line and, use whatever means necessary to stop the system, to stop carbon from being emitted, to stop things like fracking from happening. And I think each one of us needs to consider that. You know, we're literally the things that we depend on to keep us alive are being destroyed. They're being killed. They're being annihilated daily. And each one of us needs to decide what am I willing to do about that. And I guess the last thought I'd end with is, you know, I believe we're way beyond changing things regarding anthropogenic climate disruption. I think we're way past the point of no return. But if I live to be 80 or 90 years old and some little kid asked me, hey, you were alive when the Arctic ice cap still had ice on it in the summers and there was still broad ice cover of Greenland and Antarctica, and you guys at least were still sort of in a position to try to mitigate things and slow things down, what did you do? I want to be able to say I fought like hell. I want to be able to say that I did everything I could possibly dream up and think of to do, from the daily to the mundane to the extremely radical. I want to be able to say that. I don't want to have to make any apologies. And I think each one of us needs to ask themselves if they're asked by a little kid what they're going to do, what they did during this time to try to change things, improve things, make things better, stop something, what are you going to be able to say?
Well, thank you so much for your absolutely wonderful work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Darja Mayo. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.